I'm Artie Moscowen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. The U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania is getting national attention. Pat Toomey, the incumbent, is being challenged by three Democrats, Joe Sestak, John Fetterman, and Katie McGinty. We are featuring one-on-one interviews with each of the Democrats before the April 26th primary. We begin with Katie McGinty, who grew up in a big family in Northeast Philadelphia. She worked with Senator Al Gore and was President Bill Clinton's head of the White House Council on environmental quality. She later became the head of the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection in the Rendell administration. She worked in the private sector before running for Pennsylvania governor in 2014, losing to now Governor Tom Wolf. She was his chief of staff until last year, leaving that post to run for the U.S. Senate. Katie McGinty joins us on Radio Times to tell us why she wants to represent Pennsylvanians in Washington, D.C. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
What did you learn running for governor in 2014? I have to say you came in last. You got 8% of the vote. What did you learn about running across this state?
Well, first of all, in terms of what is so incredibly promising about Pennsylvania, we have in microcosm here what the country as a whole offers to the whole world, whether it is arts, culture, the science and technology that we see so alive here in Philadelphia, and Pittsburgh, and in so many different places. We have rich agricultural lands and wonderfully vibrant rural communities as well. We have diversity in our population and in our economy. And so all of that is very exciting. However, what you also see and what I've learned is that for many, many people, the challenge is real. The struggle in terms of making ends meet is deep. It's broad. It's wide. People are having a hard time out there. And for a state that has so many resources and opportunities, you know, we can do better and we will do better.
The Brookings Institution came out with a report recently talking about the concentration of poverty in Pennsylvania. It's not just that there is a poverty rate, which is obviously too high, but the concentration of poverty makes it even harder for people to maintain or sustain themselves.
You know, Marty, I was in a school, an elementary school just yesterday, and that elementary school has something on the order of 92% of all of the children. Actually, it was 100% of all the children come from households that are deep enough mired in poverty that they all qualify, thankfully, for the food programs, et cetera. But, you know, we've made a lot of progress in this country in taking on civil rights issues. Now, we have many challenges that remain, as exemplified in the Black Lives Matter movement. One of the things that concerns me is that so many of those gains stand to be lost because of this deep concentration of poverty we are seeing. But we can turn that around.
How?
It's about education. It is about making sure. One little girl I spoke to yesterday, third grader, it would both inspire you and break your heart. She sat there and told me that there's nothing she likes better to do than read. And she would go to the library and spend hours. Unfortunately, we've taken the resources away from the school such that there's no librarian in the school. The library is closed. And she said if the library was open, she would read books all day long. Schools, we've got to start with education. That's the key. It was the key for me in my life. Good jobs. You know, I'm thrilled to see the Cranes, the economic development in North Philly and elsewhere. But, you know, the crews on those cranes need to look like the neighborhood. Mm. We need to make sure that we have an inclusive economy that's giving everyone a chance and the job training and apprenticeship efforts to develop the skills that are needed.
Where do you stand on increasing the minimum wage? There's been a fair amount of talk about doing what California, some other states are doing, which is to boost it up over time to $15 an hour.
You know, this has been a top priority for me. When I ran for governor, I was the first candidate who came out really fighting for an increase in the minimum wage. And similarly, in this campaign, and I've spent an awful lot of time, wonderful time, on the front lines with those who are putting the big spotlight on this issue, whether they are certified nurse assistants, working so hard, backbreaking work and in many ways heartbreaking work. I know those CNAs took care of my own mom and dad when they were in the nursing home. It's hard work, and yet the people doing that work can't provide for themselves and their families. That's not right. So this is a big priority for me, but it comes back to what I think is a foundational principle of our country. And that is, you know, we're not about your family pedigree. We're not about your social register. We're only about hard work. And if you're willing to work hard, we've always been about rewarding that work. We're not doing that anymore. People are working hard. And if there's anything that is this campaign, my campaign is about, it's about going to bat for hardworking people so that they have the wages they deserve, the health care they need, the good schools that they need, so they can take care of themselves and their families. That's a fundamental, a foundational principle and value of our country.
You released something earlier, actually last month in March, the Economic Agenda for Women and Working Families, talking about a whole host of things, Paycheck Fairness Act and all of that. What are you going to do for men?
Well, this is for men. Families absolutely need it to be so that women and men out there working hard in the workforce are bringing home a paycheck that can pay the bills. So many times women are either the single breadwinner or a key breadwinner. So this is really about families. The other thing that's important in terms of equal pay for equal work, I'd like to see the United States join literally the entire world in providing paid family medical leave. What that does is not only honor a hardworking family, it actually would be a great stimulus to our economy. You know, equal pay for equal work is estimated to represent a $500 billion boost to our economy. Similarly, with the minimum wage, you know, when 70% of our economy is driven by consumer purchasing power, it just is economic sense put more money in people's pockets.
Let me ask you about this was a debate that happened earlier this week, and WTAE TV did some fact checking on some of the things that were said, including two things that you said, and I'm just going to read what they said. Katie McGinty falsely accused Sestak, Joe Sestak, of wanting to cut Social Security, raise the retirement age, and cut benefits, according to WTAE Fact Check. You base that accusation on brief statement that Sestak made in January, but Sestak's campaign says supporting a template to review Social Security and Medicare is not the same as supporting cuts in benefits. Can you explain your position?
Sure. And Congressman Sestak has been really quite clear about this. He has spoken to the issue of what he refers to as entitlements. And I don't think that's right. Social Security and Medicare in particular are earned benefits that people have worked for and paid into and paid for their entire working lives. And the congressman has been clear. He actually has spoken about cutting Social Security and Medicare as a matter of courage, and that the initiative called Simpson-Bowles, the congressman has said, is the proper way to cut those benefits. And that was a very detailed and specific approach that included raising the retirement age to 69 and also an across-the-board cut in the benefits themselves. I think that's wrong for two reasons. One, our seniors have earned those benefits, so I disagree with the congressman in wanting to cut them. And second, I think it's wrong because in today's day and age, some 40% of our seniors rely on Social Security for 90% of all of their income. It would be a tragedy and an impossible burden on those seniors and their families to pull that rug out from under them.
Well, Joe Sestak will be a guest on the show later this month, but quoting from his campaign as a congressman, Sestak never voted to cut benefits or raise the retirement age. In fact, he voted 41 times to protect or expand Social Security.
Well, the congressman is very clear on this point, and he's clear on it, his website, and he was clear when he spoke at the National Press Club. And in fact, as I said, didn't just speak about this in policy terms, made it a matter of moral judgment, said it is a matter of courage to stand up and call for these kinds of cuts. And I just could not disagree with the congressman more on this incredibly important point.
But should anything be done to Social Security? Some have said, look, it's important to raise that cap that, you know, above a certain amount, $100,000+, people do not pay that portion of their income into Social Security, which actually disadvantages people who rely on money for all of their money below this cap for their income.
Yeah, I think there's two things that are critically important. One is to look at and revise and raise the income cap that you are referring to. I think it's $118,000 now. The second, though, especially with respect to Medicare, is to take on the costs of health care. We have seen, as the Affordable Care Act has helped to dial down some of the increase in costs there, that it has extended the life appreciably of the Medicare trust funds. But we can go further. We're the only country in the world that doesn't allow our medical systems here, Medicare, to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies. You know, we represent probably the biggest single buyer of prescription drugs. But yet we don't negotiate the price down. That's not right. And it means that Pennsylvanians and all Americans pay many times more for prescription drugs than anybody around the world. There are other common sense things we can do. I was very proud on behalf of Governor Wolf to drive forward the expansion of Medicaid in Pennsylvania. You know, that covered 500,000. We're actually up to 600,000 Pennsylvanians now with that health insurance. But it also cuts the bill to taxpayers by more than $500 million a year. You know, another thing that I'd like to see, just by way of bringing those costs down, some transparency in terms of the cost of medical procedures. You know, there are wild differences between the cost of getting your knee replaced in one facility right down the street. It might be very significantly different, and consumers really need to know and have a right to know.
If you get into Congress, as we know, more the House than the Senate, but certainly the House has voted untold numbers of times, I think 40 or 50 times, to defund the Affordable Care Act. How would you get any of this through a Congress that exists today?
Well, this is a critically important difference, too, in terms of what Senator Pat Toomey has stood for. He has been among those that have been leading the charge to try to repeal Medicaid expansion, for example, which when 600,000 of his own constituents are benefiting greatly from that program, that seems to me to be a great disservice to his own constituents. We saw a similar pattern with Senator Toomey with respect to Planned Parenthood. He had a more extreme opinion there and effort there than even Mitch McConnell, Senator Toomey, trying to shut down literally the entire federal government to take away funds from Planned Parenthood. And there, too, 104,000 Pennsylvania women depend on Planned Parenthood. Look, these things make common sense, and as a senator, I'll fight for them, and I think there's much common ground to be had.
And much more to talk about after this very short break, talking with Katie McGinty in this hour of Radio Times, one of three Democrats running to take on incumbent Senator Pat Toomey here in Pennsylvania. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Katie McGinty. And if you're just joining us, she's the first of three interviews we're going to be doing over the next week or so with the three Democrats all running to challenge Pennsylvania Senator Republican incumbent Pat Toomey. The a primary, I should add, is April 26. Katie McGinty previously ran for Pennsylvania governor. This was back in 2014. She served as chief of staff for Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf. She headed up the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection when Ed Rendell was governor and was also environmental advisor to President Bill Clinton. To join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me go back to this debate that you had earlier this week. Again, this is WTAE-TV doing some fact-checking. The McGinty claim, and I'm just reading from what they sent out, McGinty accused Sestak of being pro-fracking. The fact check says your claim was inaccurate. McGinty accused Sestak of being pro-fracking. pro-fracking, but this is what CESTEC actually said. Drilling can assure a common good by offering reduced carbon emissions and less dependence on foreign oil, but it must not be at a greater cost or even damage to our commonwealth. The idea is that yes, you can have fracking, but you have to make sure that people aren't hurt by it. How different is that from your position?
No, precisely, Marty. The issue here is that Congressman CESTEC says he has been for a moratorium on fracking, and that is what I highlighted as not being consistent with his position. The language that you're reading from comes from the congressman's book, nearly 300-page book, where he lays out some of his programs and ideas and the platform that he's running on. He speaks extensively about fracking. Not once does he use the word moratorium. I've been consistent on this issue, and unfortunately we've seen in the congressman some flip-flopping on it.
My approach is that
we need to regulate fracking, regulate it, zone it, tax it. And I am proud in this race to be the only candidate supported by the major environmental groups in the country, the League of Conservation Voters, Environmental Defense Action Fund, Oceans Champions, et cetera, who have recognized my leadership on clean energy in particular. When we got to work with Governor Wolf, literally day one, we put back in place a ban on fracking in our state parks and forests that Governor Corbett unfortunately had lifted, and then got to work on vastly strengthened regulations on clean air and clean water, but also said, look, you need to have an environmental cop on the beat. Enforcement needs to be real. It needs to be significant. And we took the biggest enforcement action ever against a fracking company. And that was literally within weeks and just the first few months of being in office.
Let me read something from State Impact Pennsylvania, actually from Marie Cusick, who's been a guest on the show. This goes back when you were running for governor. You as saying, I don't support a moratorium. This would be on fracking. I think the responsible production and use of the Marcellus shale gas is actually part of the secret sauce as to how we will create jobs and how well we will compete and win. Now, this was a little more than 2 years ago. The whole energy environment has changed so much with a very low price for oil these days. Do you still see fracking natural gas as the secret sauce?
Well, it's an opportunity we have to grow our economy. My whole career, though, Marty, has been about breaking through this myth that, frankly, the polluters would love us to believe that you have to choose between jobs and the environment. I showed that when I led the Clinton White House Office on Environmental Quality. We pushed forward major new investments in clean water infrastructure. That was good jobs and good for the environment. When I was Secretary of Environmental Protection, similarly, we pushed forward major initiatives on renewable energy. And by the end of my tenure, we were literally one of the leading states in the country in wind energy. We were third in the country in solar energy jobs. We were on the cutting edge in energy efficiency. And that was hugely important in terms of taking on the issue of climate change. But we wound up with 3,000 new manufacturing jobs in wind energy, solar energy, $1 billion of new investment. So this old myth that you have to choose between jobs and the environment is wrong. It's hurtful. And I think with respect to any resource that we have, we need to have strong regulations. They need to be very effectively enforced. And we need to insist on continuous improvement, ensuring that we continually make it so that we sustain our clean air and clean water.
The Dimmick Township in Susquehanna County, they recently won a jury verdict about that some of the wells there for fracking contaminated their water supply. So looking back, can you say that there were the kinds of regulations and oversight that protected people from the possible leaks from natural gas drilling?
Well, when I was Secretary of Environmental Protection, this industry was only in its early infancy. I left the office in the summer of 2008. But I recognized right away how big this industry could become, and I actually called a pause to any further issuance of permits for the development of wells, and then called a summit meeting and made clear at that time most of the companies involved were all, well, still the case today, were Texas and Oklahoma companies. And they came and I said, look, there are valuable resources and invaluable resources. Gas might be valuable, but our water and our air are invaluable. And in Pennsylvania, you will not destroy our environmental quality in the pursuit of this industry. That's going to be the rule of the road. And we then proceeded to begin to develop much stronger regulations. So that started under my watch, but I left office mm-hmm. shortly after that. And my successor came in and began to really develop and strengthen those regulations that are so critically important.
But do you think they're strong enough? I mean, there certainly are concerns, either rightly or wrongly, about the effect of fracking.
I would go further. I would go further. I think that Governor Wolf now is on the right track in terms of the vastly strengthened clean water regulations that he's pushing forward and putting in place. The methane regulations that he's putting in place are going to be some of the toughest in the country. But I would, in Washington, one, take action to close a loophole that is an unacceptable loophole in the law right now called the Halliburton loophole, that says that oil and gas companies don't have fully to comply with the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. That's unacceptable. I'd push to close that. But I'd go further still, and I wouldn't allow what you see happening in Oklahoma, for example, where the fluids from the fracking process are injected back into the ground, literally causing earthquakes to be seen in Oklahoma. I would ban that practice and make it so that every ounce of water used needs to be cleaned and restored and not destroyed in the way that has been allowed in Oklahoma.
Do you see, though, I do want to move on, but do you see natural gas as a kind of a bridge fuel, as some have said, or is this something that is part of a mix of energy sources?
No, I don't buy that notion of a bridge fuel. We need to get active with high intensity right now on wind energy and solar energy. With some of the work I was able to do as secretary, we started to achieve some scale in renewable energy, and that has continued to the point where the cost of wind energy and solar energy has come down dramatically. And energy efficiency always needs to be our first choice. So as United States Senator, I will push very hard for the initiatives, the incentives, the leveling of the playing field so that efficiency comes first, renewable energy becomes an ever-growing part of the pie. Now, today, not in the future. We can do it now.
That's Katie McGinty, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And yes, she is running for U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania. Just a quick recap, Senator Pat Toomey running for re-election, Republican. He is has no challengers at this point, and there are three Democrats vying to take him on. And Katie McGinty, the first of three one-on-one interviews that we're doing for those folks who are running to challenge Senator Pat Toomey. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. A lot of comments here. Let me just read a couple to you. Let's see, an email from Lee saying, what is your position on H-1B and V-1 visas? We haven't talked about immigration, but anyone in Congress is going to have to deal with immigration. Would you be in favor of rescinding these visas to give Americans back their high-tech jobs?
Well, first of all, I do favor full and comprehensive immigration reform. I'm only second generation myself in this country. My grandparents came from Ireland. And I think actually some of the great strength of our country has come from those immigrants who come to our shores with such passion, such a determination to help build not only better lives for themselves, but to give back to a country like the United States has that has welcomed them. That certainly was my grandparents' case. You know, they came and they helped this country make our way through the Great Depression. They helped us through World War II, gave children in World War II. And that is a value that I would uphold.
Did they come legally or illegally?
Well, I believe it was 100% legally, but I guess, you know, the standards and expectations were different. And what they did do is come and fully throw themselves into the helping this country through some very challenging times. And they did that with tremendous mm-hmm. pride. As it relates to H-1B and technology jobs, look, I think that we should be welcoming of those who can bring skills. I think that grows the economy. I think it makes the pie bigger. And as some evidence of that, there was an article just the other day saying that more than half of startup companies in this country that have reached $1 billion in revenue were started by immigrants. Mm-hmm. So that is creating of jobs for us. I also had an experience when I was Secretary of Environmental Protection and very much investing in making Pennsylvania a leader in green buildings. And I met two then PhD students at Carnegie Mellon, just finishing their PhDs. They were Chinese students. They were literally on the cutting edge of some of the greenest, cleanest, most sustainable building technology in the world. They wanted very much to stay in this country and lend their talents and skills. They told me also that they had received something on the order of $200,000 in federal grants that helped to support their research. And what were we doing? Handing them a PhD funded by taxpayer dollars and then telling them they had to leave. Mm. To me, that's talent we want to keep in this country and grow cutting-edge industries.
But do we need to grow homegrown people who can do what these immigrants are doing?
Could not emphasize that more. In fact, my entire career in public service started when I was a chemist and became very much involved in early stage life sciences technology, et cetera, and saw that so many of the innovations and research is done right here. But it's invented in America and then made and commercialized in Asia or Mexico or Europe. I wrote a strategy back then to say, let's bring those jobs back home. Science education, getting girls, for example, involved in STEM, science, technology, engineering, math. I think job training and apprenticeships programs so that we have the skilled machinists, welders, everything else that we need to translate basic research into commercial products. This is one of the things that I think is most promising about how we can grow good family-sustaining jobs in this country. Last thing I'll just say on this is I would be adamant and very active in Washington to look at every tax dollar that we are spending. Are we spending that dollar by investing it in an American company that is producing American jobs? I would insist on it, and I actually think it's a national security concern because there are key technologies we're now sourcing and have to source from overseas, and I would work to turn that around.
I do want to talk about national security. A tweet from LD, please ask Ms. McGinty why she is concentrating on D.C. and New York money and no time with local Dems in Chester County. No one from her campaign has been heard from in southern Chester County / Kennett Square. That's LD.
Well, I am actually thrilled to say that the local Democratic organizations that come together in the state Democratic Party about a month ago had their statewide organizational meeting, and they voted on the candidates. And I won a significant majority of that support. So having that support from the vast majority of our Democratic grassroots leaders across the state is actually a great honor for me to have. And boy, I'll tell you, in huge numbers, folks have been coming out. They're canvassing with us. They're knocking on doors with us. They're phone banking with us. So we have terrific grassroots support, and I'm really proud about that and energized by it.
Well, you also have support from President Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, the Democratic Senate Committee, Senator Casey as well. And you know, a couple of cycles ago, endorsements would have been a great thing to get. But in today's political environment, an endorsement, I'm not saying it could be a kiss of death, but it does perhaps brand someone as an establishment candidate. And as we know, there's a segment of voters who say, we want an outsider. We don't want someone who's gotten this stamp of approval.
Well, Marty, I have to say, as a woman running for an office that Pennsylvania has never elected a woman to be a U.S. senator, if I was establishment, I think the country would be in good shape, better shape, as an environmentalist as well. It's hard to think of a lifelong environmentalist as quote-unquote establishment. But I do want to say, in terms of, for example, President Obama's endorsement of me, that comes from working directly with the White House, directly with the president and his team in taking on tough challenges like reversing Governor Corbett's decision not to expand Medicaid. That was tough work. But I rolled up my sleeves, worked directly with his team, worked through the many challenging difficulties in that and complexities in that, and we got it done. It also comes from working directly with President Obama and his team leading an advisory group on renewable energy for him and for his team. So this is about the president and others who have stepped up for me having worked with me. I'm a person who's always been in the arena. I don't like to just talk about it. I get it done. I throw in, bring people together, solve problems, drive things forward. That is what is meaningful in President Obama, the League of Conservation Voters, others. They've seen me in action, and that's why they want me to be the next United States Senator.
And we're almost up in a break here. Is your goal, though, to stop Joe Sestak? It seems that the Democratic Party doesn't like his candidacy.
Well, I'm in this race for what I believe in and what I bring to the people of Pennsylvania. And that is, you know, I come from a working family. I am in this race to stand with hardworking families throughout the Commonwealth. And I bring with me a track record of actually having wrestled with problems in a way that created good jobs, good paying jobs. You know, I'm also bringing the perspective of a working mother. And I think when Washington is so out of touch, that common sense, no nonsense, let's just solve things and dial down the drama approach would be a healthy addition to Washington, D.C.
Because you're a woman?
Well, it's just the way I approach things, and I think working moms do.
Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Katie McGinty. She is running for Senate here in Pennsylvania, U.S. Senate. And you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Again, talking with Katie McGinty. She wants to be U.S. Senator here from the state of Pennsylvania. And again, you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Cameron from, looks like Roxborough, to join us on Radio Times. Hey, Cameron, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
How do you plan to work with a Senate that's gridlocked in partisan bickering? Doesn't seem like anything gets done.
How do you plan to deal with a partisanship in Washington, D.C.?
Well, there is plenty of that for sure, Cameron. Well, what I bring to this race is 25 years of being in the arena, both in Washington and in Harrisburg, and finding that common ground. So in Harrisburg, with a decidedly Republican legislature, I'll tell you, in my early days in office, there was not a lot of enthusiasm in that legislature for renewable energy. But I worked with folks, and when I made it clear it was going to be about jobs and it would bring good new jobs, we found that common ground. We got it done. Similarly, even when Newt Gingrich took over the Congress in Washington, I was able to drive. It was a tough bargain with Newt, but able to drive a tough bargain with him to get new, important, safe drinking water protections in place. I think a couple of things are important. One is I don't believe that anybody has a lock on the truth. And so I'm a person who genuinely welcomes and encourages participation of diverse points of view. I work at building buy-in. That's important. Second, I'm also not just a creature of government. I've been out there in the private sector. I started a small business. I've served on the board of nonprofits and on bigger businesses. I've run a considerably sized business. And that means I do bring sometimes just a common sense bottom line approach that is attractive to people who want to find a way to yes, but are concerned about costs or concerned about paperwork, et cetera. And finally, Cameron, coming from ninth of 10 kids and a big Irish family, at the end of the day, if something gets really tough, I think what works is to say, hey, how about a nice cold beer? And that has worked for me throughout my career in, you can disagree, but you don't have to be disagreeable.
I'm looking at something that was actually in the Philadelphia Inquirer about your tenure as chief of staff for Governor Wolf of Pennsylvania, saying that you had a adversarial relationship with Republicans, ruffled some feathers with Republicans. Fair, not fair?
Oh, look, there are a huge array of issues. And sometimes getting to a common ground on issues involves making clear to people that compromise does not mean capitulation. And when there are important values at stake, you need to make clear right up that that's not on the table. And if that ruffles some feathers, well, then fine, you're not going to reach meaningful or positive agreement with some of those folks anyway. But sometimes it's just a necessary part of the process so everyone's clear as to what is fair game for negotiation and what would represent a complete undermining of the principles at stake. Look, I am very proud of the relationships I have on both sides of the aisle. And I want to be the first to say that the things that I was proud of accomplishing as Secretary of Environmental Protection were full partnerships with Republicans in the legislature as well. I think of local state rep Chris Ross, for example. Chris was a full partner in helping get the renewable energy legislation done. And in fact, after my tenure, he took the initiative to try to expand our requirements even further because we were so successful in meeting the increase in the build-out and the development of renewables. So it always has been a partnership for me. But that doesn't mean you roll over when an important principle is at stake. You have to be willing to take those slings and arrows. And I am. I am when something is a matter of principle.
Cameron, thanks for the call. Let's get Megan from Spring Garden on Radio Times. Megan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, what is the first bill you would introduce if you were elected to the Senate?
Good question.
Well, thanks. And it's a great question. And I'll just say, I referenced before, education is so much the key to enable people to discover and develop their talents. And I think also it's so critically important today when so many families are struggling and our kids are not necessarily coming from the best circumstances and environment, so many of them experiencing trauma in and around their home or their neighborhood. And what that says to me is catching our kids early and getting them on a track to be enriched with education early is critically important. And so for me, supporting and pushing for universal pre-K would be a top priority. And I'd be willing to say the top priority bill, number one bill that I'd love to get behind. And I'm also proud to say that Senator Bob Casey, who has endorsed me in this race, has been a real leader, and Pennsylvania should be proud. He's been a real leader on this issue in Washington, and I'd love to join forces with him.
Philadelphia mayor is, as we know, also in support of universal pre-K. How, though, can you do that from Washington, D.C.? That is such a local issue. Schools are, in many ways, locally funded, locally controlled.
Well, actually, in terms of the dollars and cents, That is supposed to be a real partnership between the federal government and state governments. And unfortunately, the federal government has not fully lived up to its part of the bargain, and the funding hasn't been there as it should for critical programs. So I would work to make sure that we are doing what's right by way of funding education and providing schools the support they need. And that does start and involve dollars and cents from the federal government.
Even though there are Republicans that want to essentially close the Department of Education.
Well, and listen, Pat Toomey, unfortunately, has been one who has pushed for cuts to education budgets. He's not supported Bob Casey's universal pre-K bill. And that's something on which I have a very different set of values and a very different set of ideas and priorities than Senator Toomey has.
Let me read a question from Rick. He says 75% of all U.S. foreign aid goes to either Egypt or Israel. This seems like a ton of money for just two countries. What does she think about that? I don't know if that's exactly correct, but certainly Israel and Egypt get, I believe, they're the number one and two of recipients of foreign aid.
Well, listen, I think especially in this day and age when we see the world on fire in the Middle East in particular and what that has meant in terms of the threat to the safety and security of Americans, that Israel in particular, Egypt has been an ally. Israel in particular, I think, is just a vital ally for the United States of America. And I think in these respects, Israel's security is our security. I think that the partnership we've had with Israel, for example, in the Iron Dome and other missile defense investments that we have been part of helping Israel with are important. I support them. And I do think that a democratic Israel, a free and open country in the middle of a part of the world that is so fraught with not only tension but terror, is essential and essentially in America's interest.
Well, we could do a whole hour on this, but some people are saying there should be no daylight between Israel and the United States. Is there a point at which you think the United States is on firm ground to be a critic of an ally?
Well, listen, I believe that we should be very actively engaged with Israel. I'd like to see us keep a focus and intention on helping to achieve a two-state solution to the challenge between the Palestinians and Israel. And I believe that Israel has every right to defend itself as we work towards that. Now, in the course of those negotiations and those conversations, sure, everybody has to give. But the fundamentals and the vital issues, I think, Israel has a right to defend itself. Moving towards a two-state solution also needs to be a vital priority, and that will take give and take from all sides.
Let me get Rosalind from Radnor to join our conversation. Rosalind, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Katie and Marty. I'm calling about Senator Toomey's ad that is fairly stomach-turning, in my view, where he heralds his own steadfast support for the militarization of the police and claims to be the one who stood up when, quote, riots were destroying our cities. In addition, he is standing strong against the President Obama's Supreme Court nominee. I believe these are examples of racism at the highest levels of government. Where do you stand, Katie, on criminal justice reform? And will you call out systemic racism wherever you encounter it in Washington?
Rosalind, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Katie McGinty, go ahead.
Well, it's a critically important point that Rosalind is making. Look, something is very, very wrong when we spend more in this Commonwealth on corrections than we spend on public colleges and universities. It's now north of $2 billion. And that number masks the terrific pain and damage that has been done to families and lives that have been compromised in terms of the ability to be able to pursue a good and fulfilling life. This is a vital priority. I would take a leadership role in looking at all nonviolent crime, taking on the issues of the mandatory minimums and the three strikes and you're out, and instead begin to, one, turn that around. I think we should take action on things like decriminalizing marijuana, for example. I think it's also an unacceptable thing.
Recreational and medicinal?
Decriminalizing, yes. Mm-hmm. And we should talk about medical marijuana, which I also believe is vitally needed. But on criminal justice reform, making it so that we're not sending our young people, you know, out of schools that are not adequately funded and locking them up, and instead providing skills, providing opportunity for our returning citizens, the same thing, making sure people come back into our communities and can be full participants in family life and economic life.
It's pretty clear that the Senate or the next Senate is going to decide on a Supreme Court nominee, whether or not Garland gets through the process today. What would you look for in a justice for the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, you know, in terms of where we are with the Supreme Court, it just is so offensive that Senator Toomey would refuse to do his constitutionally mandated job here. You know, there are not 100 different responsibilities that are laid out in our Constitution for a United States senator. There's one very clearly laid out. It is the duty of a United States senator to advise and consent when the president of the United States makes a judicial nomination. That's what's happened here. Judge Garland certainly is a person of incredible accomplishment. Republicans themselves have said that about Judge Garland. He is entitled to a full and fair hearing, and it's Senator Toomey's responsibility to ensure that he gets one. And I think the message here is simple. You know, Senator Toomey, do your job.
But what would you look for? I mean, what do you think the background criteria should be?
Well, I would be looking for a nominee who understands that our Constitution has in it a right of privacy that extends to a woman's right to choose. I would make sure that it's a nominee who understands the Constitution includes a right of association that extends to the right to organize and collectively bargain. I'd make sure it's someone who understands that we have an absolute obligation to protect our environment, clean air, clean water. Pat Toomey has made clear that he's with those that would like to pack the court to overturn marriage equality. So any nominee for me would need to convince me that he or she understands that the Constitution protects that right as well. And I will say that I think one of the motive forces here behind Senator Toomey's obstructionism in refusing to do his job with respect to the Supreme Court is the Citizens United case. That was the Supreme Court case that has allowed this flood of dark money, secret money, to come into our politics. I think a real threat to democracy. I'd like to overturn that very bad jurisprudence that is in Citizens United. And I think Pat Toomey wants to pack the court with those who would keep that bad decision in place.
Let me read one more comment. We have a lot of them. This is from Tommy. He says, our diplomatic agenda desperately needs some innovative ideas concerning dealing with religious extremist violence all over the world and certainly high on the national security agenda. What's yours, he asks.
Well, there are the very important steps that we have to take to ensure the safety of the people in this country. And I do think that as it relates to ISIS, depriving them of their caliphate is vitally important from a security point of view, because we see that's where the extremists have wreaked havoc in Europe have gone for training. But from a theological point of view, it's also important because that caliphate gives ISIS legitimacy in the eyes of some Muslims attracted to the terror that ISIS is spouting. So taking away the caliphate is
meaning
vitally
sending
important.
Sending in the military?
No, I would not think. I do not support U.S. ground troops involved in what are centuries-long, essentially civil wars. But our airstrikes together with Kurd and Sunni forces have been effective in taking back some 40% of the territory ISIS has had. But I also want to respond specifically to the question of what new ideas, because I think we have to look at some of the underlying systems here. And one of the things, as a United States senator, I'd love to push is universal education for women and girls. I think that's part of the equation of empowering women and girls to be a countervailing voice in these communities.
Well, Katie McGinty, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And she is running for U.S. Senate here in Pennsylvania. And we will be also speaking with the two other Democrats running for that same position, Joe Sestak and John Fetterman. This, of course, before the April 26th primary. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. And we did post some photographs. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.